and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, Three Identical Strangers, the documentary telling the story of triplets who were separated at birth. It's asking challenging questions about the idea of nature versus nurture. The film's director, Tim Wardle, will be with us later.
We'll also be hearing from Icelandic conceptual artist Ragnar Kjartansson, whose recent work has seen him collaborating with US rock band The National.
And we'll be hearing from writer and author Amanda Siebert, whose new book, The Little Book of Cannabis, asks how marijuana can improve your life.
That's all coming up. Don't get any ideas, org. Plus, Monocle's Bill Luthi will be looking ahead to some of next week's news events, and we'll enjoy some great music too right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We are again, Augustin Macellari.
I know, it's like the gift that keeps on giving, week after week.
I love the Monocle Weekly, and it's been a busy old week here at Midori House, hasn't it? Our print colleagues, you know, you dabble a little, but they've really got their nose to the grindstone. Two different products they've sent off this week. Absolutely extraordinary.
I know, relentless.
Workload.
Yeah, how many words do you think they've written each?
10 to 15 million.
Wow.
It's a lot.
That is a lot.
It's been very, very busy, a hive of activity. But what's exciting, we're still making time for just fascinating people from all around the globe to come in and talk to us. I cannot wait to hear from some of the luminaries we've got in store on the weekly.
I'm excited. I think it's an unusually strong roster. Not unusually strong.
It's good every week.
A standardly strong roster.
One thing I should mention is we're going to be hearing from Tim Wardle, the director of Three Identical Strangers. That is a quite extraordinary story, and I won't preempt the conversation with Tim a little later. Absolutely remarkable. It's been a sort of a, not I was going to say a sleeper hit, it's been a breakout hit globally, and our listeners, if they're still uncertain now, once they've heard from Tim, they'll definitely be tuning in. But it's a quite, quite remarkable story.
It really is.
Well, on with the show. Plenty of incredible guests to bring in. None of them quite ready yet, so let's start with Bill Luthi.
Which way you going, Billy? Can I go too?
Where are you going, Billy, this week?
We're going to Brussels. First of all, today, they're there, they're now. The 27 European leaders of what will be the European Union once we get the hell out of there are meeting today to decide whether or not to endorse the proposed Brexit deal that we've spent, well, a very, very long time coming up with.
Too long, it seems.
Maybe not long enough.
Can I go out on a limb and say I'm not that optimistic this one's going to work?
Well, lots of people were kind of saying Angela Merkel was like, maybe I won't even bother going. So, you know,
it's not great.
It's not a good
It's not
sign,
what you could call a full unequivocal endorsement.
She's really dialing it in now, isn't she, Angela?
I don't know. I think she's still invested in the medium term future of the bloc.
I think one of the surprising things about this is, and if you listen to the Foreign Desk, which I recommend the 27 EU leaders should have done, or at least the negotiators, quite a long time ago we did a show about what the hell's going to happen to Gibraltar. It seems no one's really thought about that. And that's one of the biggest sticking points that they're going to come across today. It's quite serious. I mean, there's not going to be a war between Gibraltar and Spain, but, you know, it's going to be a bit awkward.
Listen, borders is never easy. Look at what's happening on the island of Ireland. And the idea that, oh, well, nobody mentioned it, nobody saw it coming. Quite a few people did, but yeah. no one chose to listen.
If Andrew Muller can work it out, surely.
That is, in threshold terms, pretty low. Bill, what else?
Tomorrow, Monday night, save your stomachs. Maybe have quite a light lunch because it's the British Curry Awards 2018.
What goes on there?
It's actually a huge event. I'm going to use the ticket price as an example of how large the event is. £165 per person.
How much free curry do you get for that?
I'd imagine it's an all-you-can-eat curry buffet.
One dish from each nominated.
Ooh, they'd all bring them along. Last year, Dishoom. Have you been to Dishoom here in London?
Of course.
They won Best Newcomer. So, you know.
Well deserved.
And, okay, I'm going to read some of the previous attendees as
well. Let's have a listen.
Star-studded. Tell me what you think about these. Vince Cable MP.
Underwhelmed.
Krishnan Gurumurthy.
Whelmed.
Jimmy White.
Who's our global listeners and org will need to do some Google research. A legend of the Bays.
The what?
Still doesn't know.
Oh, snooker.
You're talking about the snooker playing legend?
Yeah.
Is he a curry aficionado?
Apparently. And this one's going to get you. David Seaman.
Again, one for our global listeners, former Arsenal and England goalkeeper.
With loud shirts.
If they've got him shirts, leaning over the buffet, I hope he's got a little net to put over his moustache.
He's got rid of his moustache.
Has he indeed?
That happened about 15 years ago.
Getting too much curry caught in it.
And his ponytail.
Star-studded event.
That is extraordinary.
Bill, what else? Well, on Wednesday, it's the World Forum on Urban Forests in Italy, which kind of, I like the sound of this.
It's growing on me.
Oh, we're gathering local authorities, urban foresters, arborists, landscape architects and urban planners to discuss how we can make cities better places to live, more sustainable, healthier for our lungs. I live in Brixton on one of the worst roads for fumes. Sadiq Khan has built what he calls Brixton Orchard, which is about, I don't know, 10 by 10 metres with about 10 trees.
It's not an orchard, is it?
It doesn't look good at the moment, but apparently once that grows, it's going to be better for my lungs.
I don't think that's even going to touch the sides on Brixton Road.
Exactly. Well, that's what these guys are trying to sort.
I like that. I like trees, and I like trees in an urban setting.
Have you ever met anyone who doesn't like trees?
No.
No, neither have I.
And Bill. Moving on towards the end of the week, Friday, and then throughout the weekend, it's the G20 summit in Buenos Aires. Mm. People are going to be talking. I mean, the Argentinians have decided the motto is building consensus for fair and sustainable development. They want to talk about the future of work, infrastructure, sustainable food. I think what's going to be on everybody's minds is trade. Everyone's fighting about trade. Mm. The US and China are fighting about trade, the EU. We don't know what we're going to do with all the other countries once we're out of there. It's going to be a bit of a free-for-all, isn't it?
Mm. And no one will want to stand next to Mohammed bin Salman.
I was going to say, is he even going to go? It's a very awkward situation if he's there getting... We've seen those pictures of Theresa May getting snubbed, haven't we, at the EU conferences. So he's probably just going to be stood there on his own.
It is very interesting that now the sort of weird personality-driven nature of political gatherings is such that who's going to be there and what kind of greeting they give out or receive, that dominates the agenda more than anything of actual substance.
Who has smiled at who?
It's not great.
And is that the intrusion of sort of celebrity-obsessed culture into politics?
It could be. Either way, it's not doing the vast majority of people much good.
All the big topics, which are very, very important, work, infrastructure and sustainable food.
Mm. As you said, though, trade front and centre, and perhaps rightly so, maybe we can come away from one of these big gatherings with something really concrete and positive rather than something nebulous and, if anything, negative.
I mean, I hope so, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
There we go. Flying the flag of optimism is Monocle's Bill Luty. Thank you, Bill. Always good to hear from you. Coming up on the Monocle Weekly in just a moment, we'll be hearing from Tim Wardle, the director of Three Identical Strangers. Over the past few years, we've arrived into rather a golden age of documentary. Phenomenal stories drawn from life and artfully told have captured audiences' imaginations. This year, A Tale of Three Brothers from New York has transfixed viewers and scooped up award after award at film festivals around the world.
Three Identical Strangers tells the story of a set of triplets separated in infancy and unknown to one another and their extraordinary reunion. Alongside its touching exploration of fraternal bonds, however, it weaves a darker tale. As the film unfolds, it raises questions about the ethics of science, the struggle between nature and nurture, and the power of family as an antidote to hereditary trauma. Its director, Tim Wardle, joins us now. But first, let's hear a clip.
I wouldn't believe the story if someone else were telling it, but it's true, every word of it. It started when I went to college. It was the first day of school. All these people are coming up to me saying, Eddie, how are you? Eddie, hi. I'm like, my name's not Eddie. I don't know what you're talking about.
As soon as this guy turned around, I knew it was Eddie's double. I said, you're not gonna believe this. You have a twin brother.
Oh my God.
And then the story went from being amazing to incredible.
It was an article to Twins Reunited. I think I might be the third.
That's when things kind of got funky.
Something was just not right.
I'd never made a film in the US before, and I've made quite a lot of TV docs in the UK, and it is striking how extraordinarily good Americans are at telling stories. And it came to make me feel that there is something embedded in the national psyche about storytelling. There's just a sense there that, like, I have a story, I'm going to tell it to you as best I can. I'm going to be completely kind of upfront about it and open about it. There's not going to be any kind of reticence. Sometimes in the UK, you get people, even if they really want to tell their story, because of the kind of British character, there's a sense that I've got to pretend I don't want to tell my story, even though I think it's really good and I want to share it. And Americans don't have that. And out there, we filmed 14 interviews and used 13 of them. So that kind of ratio would be unheard of in the UK.
And Tim, just in terms of your experience then, I guess, as the sort of, the filmmaker, the film describes almost a sort of fairly conventional arc initially, and then it does go into this much darker territory, and we might have to issue some sort of spoiler alerts as we discuss in more detail. As you sort of got into the piece, did you become more aware of your directorial responsibilities? Because there's some quite challenging kind of conceptual stuff almost to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that making documentaries in the UK... I mean, the UK has this incredible documentary tradition. The quality of documentaries you see just on television is unbelievable compared to any other country in the world. And so I think I've got a really good grounding working here in kind of the ethics of documentary filmmaking. But you're right, I mean, the story does massively shift. And I think very consciously, I knew that it was going to start out almost like this kind of... like a sort of John Hughes movie, or like a kind of, me and the editor, Michael Hart, we watched a lot of 80s films, like even like bad ones, like Secrets of My Success and things like that, to kind of get that first third, the sort of energy of it and the kind of feel. And then it does transition, and it does take quite an abrupt tonal change. And that is quite unusual especially for documentary, but for film in general, what you generally do is establish a tone at the start and then you kind of stick with it. And we knew with this, it was going to almost switch genres a third of the way in and then probably even switch again. It becomes more of like almost like an identity thriller or something like that, with a bit of kind of conspiracy thrown in. And managing that was challenging, and the moves between the different moods of the film. But I think that as a director, what you want to do is make people feel, that's what I'm trying to do. And Hitchcock has this great thing he said about when someone asked him, what's your job as a director? He was like, to put the audience through it. And that was kind of like with this, I was like, I almost felt like I had a duty of care, not just to the people in the film, but also to the story itself, because it was so extraordinary, to tell it the best I could tell it and take the audience on this kind of wild ride. And it really is a wild ride that, you start off in one place, end up somewhere completely different. So that kind of manipulation of the audience was absolutely, a conscious thing I was doing from the start.
The story, as you say, is completely extraordinary. And I mean, they were famous when they were first reunited, these three triplets. One was mistaken for another when he arrived at university, discovered that he had a twin, and it was only when the third one's adopted mother saw her son's doubled in the newspaper and recognised his fat hands, which kind of struck a chord with me, I have to say, when I was watching that they then realised they were triplets. So it starts off with this amazing story and takes this darker turn. I wanted to ask a bit about how, for you as a filmmaker and your team, the twist, as it were, started to unfold itself. A lot of documentary now, maybe since Serial, the podcast, has kind of been concerned with exploring the mechanics of journalism at the same time as it follows its story. And I wanted to get your reflections on whether that was really ever an option, when you were suddenly confronted with this extraordinary kind of conspiracy that the triplets were part of.
I mean, I think that we knew from the start a large portion of their backstory. It hadn't been widely discussed in the press, but we'd spoken to enough people, so we knew that it took this big dark twist about a third of the way, halfway through. And I think that stylistically, the one thing that I was always very conscious of, I wanted, as I've said, the audience to kind of experience what the triplets went through. So we made the decision to kind of force the perspective of the audience. And this is something that people do, drama filmmakers do all the time. Point of view is really important. Documentary people tend to be a bit less focused on that, and things can take a bit more of a bird's eye view. And so in this film, we're going to force our perspective. So we're going to literally start over the shoulder of the brothers as they're discovering things. And every reveal that happens in the film happens in the chronology that it happened to the brothers. So, the audience is experiencing information as it was revealed to the brothers at the time. And that was really, really important to me, that the audience are aligned with the triplets and what they went through. And so you can kind of experience it more. It is an entertaining story. And I make no bones about that. You know, I think documentary can be entertaining as well as, you know, informative and make, you know, making people think. The brothers themselves were very much like, when we agreed to make the film, which took like 4 years to convince them to make the film, they were like, you know, our story is a great story and we want it to be told that way. It's not a story that we want it to be told as a sad story. We want it to be told as a, you know, with all the emotions that we experienced.
And I guess to that point, there, and we don't want to sort of give away too much of the arc of the whole piece, but there are kind of questions, fairly profound questions that remain unanswered in terms of this sort of conspiracy that Aug alluded to before. Does that leave you with that kind of almost cliffhanger ending? There is this uncertainty, unanswered questions, or is there a degree of frustration there? Because you do want to sort of have a point at the end, don't you?
It's a really good question. Like, when I was starting work on it, I was like, I've got to answer every question that there is by the end of it. And I was really like, you know, if we don't, you know, there's a secret archive that is locked until 2066. And part of the film is the brothers' attempts to get this archive open, which they think will have all these answers. And I think I was like, we have to open that. We have to answer everything for the film to make sense. And actually, what I came to realise making the film is that actually having a kind of Pandora's box, or actually that's the wrong analogy, but a box that you'd never open, is actually a good thing, because it's this enduring mystery that kind of drives the story. And at the end, there's still this kind of injustice which continues. And I think with documentary particularly, having a film where you leave wanting more answers and feeling frustrated and angry with some of the things that have happened in the film is not a bad thing. And wrapping everything up neatly in a bow, actually, for docs, is not great. And, you know, like, things have happened since the film's come out, like two more twins have found themselves who are adopted from the same agency. You know, one of them watched the film, a woman called me and she said, oh, I've just seen your film and I was adopted from the same agency around the same time, and I've taken a DNA test and it's matched with someone who lives 500 miles from me, and they reunited and I filmed them reuniting at the age of 54, twins separated at birth. So it's just kind of extraordinary that the film and the kind of legacy of the film kind of keeps evolving. And I think even if I tried to tie it down, I think it would have resisted that.
Do you worry then that you might be, I don't know what the directorial equivalent of being typecast as, oh, he's the go-to guy, get the twins together, get Tim along, he's the guy to shoot this.
I keep on being asked if there's a follow-up, and I think there probably is, but I think after, it's now pretty much 6 years since I started work on it, it's time to kind of hand the baton over, really. I'm sort of, I love the story, I love the people involved, but it's taken up a huge chunk of my life. Yeah.
Is that kind of really interesting interface between like super filmic and documentary filmmaking? Is that something that how did you arrive reach that decision to go for that? And is it something that you want to keep going with, or do you want to start moving into fictional filmmaking?
It's a really great question. I mean, there are people who make documentaries who feel that, and there's a whole sort of school of thought that documentaries should be like one specific way of making it, and there are all these different factions that are like, you know, you do it can't have any commentary, or you can't ever hear the director's questions, or you can't ever, you know, acknowledge the fact that a film's being made. And other people are like, you should always be, you know, self-reflexive and acknowledging the film's being made. And my take on documentaries, it's like really broad church, and that actually it's really good to encompass all these influences. And, you know, I've worked in documentaries for almost 20 years, but I love fiction films. I started off working on as a runner on fiction, and I love genre cinema, and I wanted to use all those influences in the film. And so it was very conscious, I think, that I just felt like at any point in the film I wanted to use the technique that was needed to tell the story the best. As I was saying earlier, that it's all about the story and foregrounding the story. So if I needed to use reconstruction, I'm going to do that. If I need to use sit-down interview, I'm going to do that. If I need to use archive and TV montage, I'm going to do that. And I sort of had no bones about just, you know, magpieing all my favourite bits from other documentaries and drama films. In terms of what I want to do next, I mean, I would really like to do some scripted stuff, and I'm talking to various people about those kind of projects, like full drama, but also this kind of hybrid place where documentary and drama meet, I'm really interested in. And like, you know, Bart Layton, who made The Imposter, and American Animals, who I work with, you know, he's kind of pioneered that. And I think it's a really interesting space, because I think the boundaries between the two are getting more blurred every year.
Well, just on that point about blurring boundaries, Tim, and it was something that you said in your last answer that made me think of this. You look at something like, I don't know, Making a Murderer, that Netflix thing, and there's questions about, well, hang on, this was one-sided, this was the director's reading. Do you even think about that idea? Do people ask you about how objective you are? Do you say, well, look, hang on, I'm a I'm a director of a film. I'm not a journalist. I'm not claiming to be.
Yeah.
You know, is that important, is to have that consideration? Or do you just say, look, I'm making a piece. Watch it. Don't watch it. Don't worry. But don't, you know, don't have those expectations of me. I'm not trying to say this is the some kind of gospel truth of the matter.
Sure. I think if you start going down a route of trying to make an objective film, I think most people agree now that the idea of kind of objectivity in filmmaking and in art in general is just not, you know, it's not valid. You know, everything is subjective in some level or other. You drive yourself nuts trying to be totally objective. I mean, what is certainly true is that this film could have been made a number of different ways. There are a lot of elements we've left out of the film that you can see, and people always ask us questions like, well, where are the sisters? Why don't you interview the sisters? Why don't you do this? And they're all valid. It was just that I chose to make this film about the brothers' story and focus on them. And there was absolutely enough material here for a Making a Murderer style multi-part series. And there was a lot of pressure on us to do that. But I've always been a big fan of films where there's like a surplus of narrative and like, everything isn't explained, and it is so packed and dense with twists and material that you have to maybe watch it a second time. And I like those films. And so, I mean, the other thing is that I've seen so many feature docs this year, you know, watching them at festivals and stuff, and a lot of them struggle narratively to kind of go past about the 60, 70 minute mark, and they start to feel stretched. And you see that with some of the series as well. And I was just like, look, I'm going to wait until I find an idea where it has enough meat in it to sustain a 90-minute film. I can, you know, ask people to pay money and go and sit in the dark and watch it for 90 minutes. And this was the first idea, honestly, in like 20 years that I'd found that I was like, this deserves a cinematic retelling. And that's, so I always wanted to do that, and I didn't want to go down this, let's see how long we can stretch it out for a series kind of approach.
Within that, you know, because it's clear as an audience member, you see it and it throws up so many questions that all are interesting and all justify more research separately and all seem like they could potentially be different avenues for the film to go down. What was the process like of editing yourselves? Was it very much by committee, or was it something that you kind of steered in deciding not to include the sisters, in leaving certain avenues uninterrogated?
I think there was a degree of committee in that I always take advice from too many people, you know, particularly when I'm editing, but ultimately, I mean, that is your job as a director, to kind of decide what the story is and what aspects of it you want to focus on. I also, you know, everyone working on the film apart from the exec producer pretty much were first-time feature film director makers, and I had this great editor, young editor Michael Hart, who it's his first feature, and he just worked like an absolute dog, and he, you know, he had specific ideas about certain aspects of the story. But really, I think that's your job as a director, to kind of choose which bits you want to focus on. I had a very clear idea, I think, certainly with the retrospective stuff. So about two-thirds of the film is past tense. And past tense documentary making and present day actuality observational filmmaking are I see them as almost different genres. It's like a horror film and a romantic comedy. They're so separate. And the hardest thing really was getting those two bits to kind of fit together, because the past tense stuff, we really knew, we had a lot of detail and you could really plan it out, and that stuff cuts very tight and you can pace it almost like a thriller. When you move into observational footage, which is what my background's in, that stuff tends to have more fat on it, just because it, you know, you don't know exactly what you're looking for when you're filming. You don't know where things are going. It was a huge problem getting funding for the film, because people kept saying, well, what's the third act? Where does it go? Where's it, you know, how's it going to end? And so making those two work together was a challenge. And you have a scene in the film where the triplet brothers in interview get up, stand up and walk out of the interview. And that was my editor trying to make the kind of interview space into this observational space. It's like a kind of decompression section between the two parts of the types of film that are within the documentary.
That's really interesting. Tim, just finally, what about, we mentioned already in our introduction that, you know, recognised at awards, you've already said you've been sort of very much on the kind of festival circuit. How's that? Are you a director that doesn't mind getting out there and meeting the fans? And I'm doing those quote marks. It's obviously pretty tiring. You've got a young family. But is there enough sunshine in amongst all of that mayhem to make it worthwhile?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, this is a dream come true. I wanted to be a director since I was like 14. And for this film, which was just a little film that we thought might just end up, you know, going out on Channel 4 or whatever, to get picked up at Sundance and then picked up for distribution in the US and then to earn, I don't know, it's like $12.5 million at the box office in the US, it's just a dream come true. And every day when I'm not totally exhausted, I wake up and pinch myself and say, this is, you know, my editor always wakes up at these festivals and is like, this is the best day of my life. And the next day I'll be like, this is the best day of my life. You know, we all wanted to make films that people went and saw in the cinema. So I love meeting people. I love talking about the story. And it's just been the wildest roller coaster that I don't think I'm going to process for about 5 years.
Excellent. Well, when you do, maybe you come back again and give us the 5 years on view.
Probably that'd be great.
A few more gems at that point. Tim, really great to chat with you. Thanks for coming to see us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And Tim Wardle's film, Three Identical Strangers, is out now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
It's time for a tune. We'll be hearing about Ragnar Kjartansson's collaboration with The National in the moment. So here is the band themselves with their rather upbeat Day I Die.
I don't need you, I don't need you. Besides, I barely ever see you anymore. And when I do, it feels like you're only halfway there. Young mothers love me, even ghosts of girlfriends call from Cleveland. They will meet me anytime.
The National there with Day I Die from their most recent record, Sleep Well, Beast.
Over the past month at 180 The Strand in London, an enormous labyrinthine video art exhibition has been taking place. It's called Strange Days, Memories of the Future, and is a collaboration between the Vinyl Factory and the New Museum. With 21 artists on show and over 12 hours of video, there's certainly a lot to take in. One of the pieces on show is called A Lot of Sorrow by the Icelandic artist Ragnar Kjartansson. It's a six-hour film of The National, from whom we just heard, playing their song Sorrow over and over and over again to a crowd of fans in New York.
It's a performance piece of endurance and, despite its title, joy. And Monocle's Holly Fisher recently spoke to Ragnar about making it.
Sorrow found me when I was young.
Ragnar, the piece you've got showing here is called A Lot of Sorrow, and it's The National playing the same song over and over again for 6 hours. How did you persuade them to do that, first of all?
You know, I just wrote them an email and asked them if they thought this was if they were up to do this, and they just said, yes, we are. It was, the main question was, like, if Brian the drummer could do it, it's because it's totally insane to drum this for 6 hours, but he heroically did it.
What was it about that particular song that made you want them to perform that?
Oh, it's just sort of the idea about kind of turning a song into a sculpture painting. And suddenly I was just doing the dishes, listening to A Lot of Sorrow for probably the 800th time, when I just realized, like, this is a song I need to make a piece about, because it is just so gorgeous. It's like, it's one of the most gorgeous songs I've heard, because it's just, like, rhythmically and the melody and just the mood in it. And of course the gorgeous lyrics, which are so beautifully kind of depictive of melancholia and sadness in a sort of a joyful way.
I mean, the piece is called A Lot of Sorrow, yeah, because the song is called Sorrow. But it's actually quite a joyful piece of art that you've made, but that's mostly due to the relationship between the band and the audience. You know, you've got this man singing about really sad things over and over again for 6 hours, but the audience have really got his back and they want him to carry on and get to the end of it and play it again. And I love the ending when they ask for an encore. And were you expecting to end up with such a joyful piece of video art at the end of making this?
No, I was not. No, because it's always like, I didn't know what to expect, but I was curious. This piece ended up with being something, yeah, something really warm. Mm. In all this kind of, because then also in the aesthetics, I wanted it to be really cold. You see, like the stage is just like white and there's just smoke. So it's sort of, I always thought that this should be like a Gerhard Richter painting. Like a cold German painting. And but then like the emotional substance is so warm, which I'm really happy about. And of course, that's also how they are as a band. They're a very generous band, I would say.
I mean, you've done a few different pieces of work that have been people performing the same song over and over again. But the thing about this particular piece that makes it different is that the people performing it are the people who made it.
Yeah.
How did that make this a different piece from, say, The Sky in a Room or the piece you did with the Mozart piece?
I mean, it's very different to have the songwriters themselves perform it. I mean, I have other instances where I... Because it's sort of a form I've been working with like, where you make a song sculptural or painterly. Yeah, there's something quite gorgeous about the performer doing it. But in other instances, I wouldn't want the performer to do it. So it's... Every piece kind of calls for existence. Like, you know, like, El Cielo en una Stanza was about that space and people from Wales who were kind of new to the song, about doing the song, but not, like, having a...
Yeah, that was very reflective of the room it was in the instrument it was being played on. And, I mean, this is a sort of site-specific place you did in a museum in Wales.
You know, different from having Gino Paoli perform it. You know, that's like when there's the star performing it, something completely different happens. Then it's, in a way, stops being the song and becomes the performer of the song. But that is also interesting about the National, because they have this quality of nobody. I mean, they're really big stadium-filling rock stars, but they're not like stars. They just are the song. And even like in the way they dress and all this stuff, it's just like, I am performing this song. And it's really not like a... Because my godmother was a singer, she would always dress in black and say like, a singer should never come in between the song and the audience. And weirdly, like, the National have that quality.
Yeah, even on a big stage, they're quite an intimate band. What were the band like before they went on stage and then when they came off stage at the end of that six-hour performance? Were they broken men or were they okay?
Well, the band was... They are such cool cats. I mean, there was hardly any difference in how they were before they came on stage and then 6 hours later when they went off stage. They were just in really good... Actually, they were, you know, like... When they went on stage, they were sort of like serious, like, you know, now we're going for it. You know, like a skier in the moment before he goes down in the Olympics. And afterwards, it was just very joyous. And, you know, we just all went to a restaurant and ha-ha-ha and drank wine and ate pasta. It was fun.
Ragnar Kjartansson there, speaking to Holly Fisher, and Strange Days, Memories of the Future, is on at 180 The Strand until the 9th of December. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Canada recently legalised the use of cannabis. It means that attitudes to the once prohibited drug are rapidly having to be rethought, and it also means a huge new industry has sprung up around its use. Journalist Amanda Siebert has been covering cannabis-related issues for some time. Her new book, The Little Book of Cannabis, aims to educate, perhaps dispel a few myths, and maybe open a few minds too. Earlier, she spoke to Augustine on the line from her home in Vancouver to talk a little more about it.
How did you latch on to cannabis as your subject as a journalist?
When I began working at The Strait, I was a bit of a what you'd call a generalist. So I was covering everything from music to art to beer, and cannabis was sort of mixed in with that a little bit. And I guess sort of after writing a series of those stories, my editors noticed that I sort of had an affinity for writing about cannabis. And perhaps they picked up on the fact that I was a user. And so they approached me and they asked me if I would be interested in writing about cannabis on a more consistent basis. And I jumped at the opportunity. I think it's definitely something that, you know, our society has a little bit of a skewed impression of because of, you know, the way this plant has been talked about over the last 100 years. And so I saw it as an opportunity for me to speak to cannabis in a little bit of a different way. Obviously, you know, when you're a journalist, you're covering the news, you're writing about many different aspects of it. For me, you know, for everything from writing about patients who were struggling with access to different studies that were coming out. And of course, in Canada and the United States, there's a lot of action on the stock market. So a wide variety of topics. But just, yeah, it provided me with an opportunity to sort of speak about it in a little bit of a different way.
You mentioned there that there's been this kind of historically skewed attitude towards it, which in the book you say is really only about a century sort of at the most old. I wanted to ask a bit about the shift that's taken place in social attitudes towards the drug over the last few years. You know, as recently as 2015, Stephen Harper, Canada's Prime Minister, was calling cannabis infinitely worse than tobacco. You know, and now Canada's the first G7 nation to completely slacken cannabis laws. So where is that change happening? What's it come from?
In Canada, we sort of move through, like our relationship with cannabis has sort of changed. It sort of began as a more medicinal approach. And, you know, now we see recreational legalization happening. I think it's a combination of looking at states in the United States that have legalized cannabis in these ways. You know, medical cannabis has been legal in Canada since about 2001. But I think this move, the decision to legalize recreationally comes from the sort of attitude that we have towards cannabis because of medical use. You know, there's a belief that, oh, perhaps people are faking medical conditions to access cannabis. Canadians are very much a large population of cannabis users. One of the reasons that cannabis was legalized as well is because we have the highest population of young people who use cannabis, and so the government's idea was that by legalizing it and regulating it, we would be able to keep it out of the hands of young people. That's one aspect of it. You know, the sort of public health and safety approach, I think, has a lot to do with why our attitudes have shifted. We've recognized that, you know, perhaps the harms and the risks associated with using this plant are not as big and scary as we once imagined that they were. And really, there's just a desire by the public, by consumers, to use this substance. And so, you know, obviously there are things like tax revenue associated with the government's decision to move forward. Perhaps they don't talk about it as much, but definitely a large part of it as well. So I think it's definitely a combination of things. With Stephen Harper no longer in the government, we have, you know, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who's a little bit more progressive. And so I think it's really a combination of shift in government and a sort of collective shift in attitudes.
What I'm really interested by is, you know, as you make clear in the book, cannabis has got this sort of ancient history of use by people for all manner of different ailments, different ritual functions. And today there is still a really big appetite for it. And kind of in spite of the century of prohibition that we've just had, which is now maybe arguably starting to give way, it's endured as a thing that people go back to. What I want to know is, what was it about the kind of 1930s legislators, these sort of mean old guys who were basically denouncing it? What was it about that anti-dope smoking narrative that was so compelling that it kind of changed social attitudes towards it for 100 years?
I think there's a lot of fear associated with cannabis at the time. You know, we didn't have the access to the information that we have now. People's experiences are shared widely on the internet. We're all talking about the different ways we find cannabis to be, you know, beneficial and things like that. But at that time, there wasn't really a lot of discussion about it. Obviously, there are other political factors that played into why that discussion came about. At that time, hemp, cannabis's cousin, if you will, was really an industry on the rise. But so were, you know, plastic and pharmaceuticals and cotton as well. And so these are three industries that were threatened by hemp. You know, anything that you can make out of plastic, out of cotton, you can make out of hemp. And really, pharmaceuticals, you know, some people are of the mind that you could perhaps use cannabis instead of opiates, say, to treat your pain. And so it was really a combination of political will to sort of see that hemp industry kind of pushed aside. And really, you know, racism played a large part in it too in North America, especially because a lot of the people that were consuming cannabis and were bringing it to the United States and to Canada were from outside of the country. And so, yeah, I think it's really, really a combination of racism and kind of a will to sort of see hemp and cannabis villainized so that these other industries could sort of be brought to the forefront.
As you just mentioned, this kind of weird notion of social decay, at least from here, have seemed to be the driving forces behind cannabis prohibition in North America. In the UK, anti-cannabis arguments tend to centre around mental health, psychotic episodes, schizophrenia, these kind of negative mental health associations that kind of have been linked to overuse. And obviously in your book, you talk about the positive impact it can have on anxiety and these kinds of issues. And I just wondered what your reflections are, how you kind of square those two poles.
Yes, it's definitely a little bit polarizing, but I will say that, you know, what's often left out of the conversation when we hear about cannabis and psychosis or schizophrenia is that if you have a predisposition to psychotic episodes, if it runs in your family, then you're obviously much more likely to experience this. And I think the misunderstanding is that people assume that everybody is at risk of getting schizophrenia or having a psychotic episode after they use cannabis, and that I don't believe that to be the case. There's science to back that up as well. And when it comes to anxiety, you know, whether or not it is aggravated or sort of relieved with cannabis, it very much comes down to the individual and also to the type of product that you're using. The thing about cannabis is it's not a single compound medicine. There are many different things within the plant and really within different strains of the plant that can have different effects on people. So what I talk about in the book when it comes to anxiety is, you know, really searching for the right kind of product, one that perhaps is higher in a compound called CBD or cannabidiol, which is known to not exactly have these intoxicating effects that come with THC. So it sort of cuts some of that euphoria that for a lot of people can actually bring about anxiety. So there's certainly two sides to the coin here.
To come on to the book, you know, it's a lovely edition. I've got it in front of me. It's really nice, really beautifully designed, quite understated looking. It doesn't resonate with the mental image a lot of people might have of cannabis culture, of this kind of, you know, cartoons of Homer Simpson with red eyes smoking a great big spliff and things like that. I wanted to ask a bit about how social attitudes towards the drug are shifting. While I was researching this, I found some articles about the surging popularity of cannabis use among soccer mums in California. And is that part of a kind of general PR move to move it away from the subcultural thing it was forced to be as a consequence of a century of prohibition? Is it about new ways of ingesting it that we've found? Is it about breaking it down into the component parts like you just described? How is it that it's being brought kind of into mainstream society?
I think it's a combination of everything you've just mentioned, but especially because I think really what it is there are so many people around the world that use cannabis, and when we see more and more people coming out with their, you know, oh, the fact that they like to smoke a joint, you know, after work instead of, you know, have a pint or things like that. And when we see sort of where these people are in society, how prominent they might be, you know, I know many, many, you know, CEOs and lawyers and very successful people that use cannabis daily. And so I think really that is what is the key to changing the stigma, is people talking about the fact that they use cannabis, that they enjoy it, that perhaps it helps them with this ailment, or they use it recreationally. You know, I'm not here to say you should be using cannabis in a medicinal way, but I think having those conversations with people, being upfront about use and sort of, I mean, the way it's often put is coming out of the green closet. it's sort of an interesting image to me, and I really think that that sort of thing, having those conversations with people, is what is going to collectively kind of help us suspend that disbelief that we have about cannabis and really overcome the stigma that a lot of us have been sort of ingrained with.
The medical uses of cannabis have, I think, for a lot of people, maybe been the cause of rolled eyes. You know, oh, someone's got glaucoma, better go down to the dope shop and take their doctor's thing. But it's fascinating to hear that it does, in fact, have this actual physical effect.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating substance, and there's so much about it that we still need to learn and that we're confirming. This book was really just a way of me approaching the science that we've already got, the anecdotes that we've heard from people, and really combining that with historical references. I think that, to me, is one of the most powerful things. You know, a lot of people are under the impression that cannabis is this new thing, but really it's something that humans have been using for thousands and thousands of years. And so when we combine that historical knowledge with the research that we do have, with expert testimony, with testimony from patients and consumers, I think it really does speak to how powerful it can be.
That's really interesting that you brought that up, because one of my favorite bits of the book, are these little asides where it refers to, you know, Emperor Shen Nung, for example, who was a pioneer in discovering herbal medicine in ancient China. I wanted to ask a bit about, you know, what you did learn from researching these disparate cultural groups, Vikings using cannabis in sex orgy rituals against Emperor Shen Nung using it medicinally. Were there kind of common threads that you found that people had been reliably doing the same thing with the drug? I mean, and have people always used it recreationally just to get stoned and have fun as well?
I think for sure people have probably used it in that way. I think spiritually is also a way that I found was quite interesting. I don't talk about it super in depth in the book, but that was definitely a common thread, that it was often, you know, groups that were tied to a certain religion. That was, I would say, a common thread. Pain, it really, like, his name is Dr. Ethan Russo. He's a very, very well-known cannabis researcher, and he has said that, you know, every civilization has used cannabis in some form or another for pain treatment. In one of his papers, I believe it's referenced in the back of my book. But I think that's fascinating that, you know, this is something we've used in a very specific way, whether that be, you know, in a topical form, if it's mixed in with an oil, or whether it's smoked or ingested. It's something that we found to be effective for pain relief for a long, long time. So yeah, that would be probably one of the biggest threads common through those historical references.
Finally, I just wanted to ask about how other drugs can be used medicinally. I know that your focus is on cannabis and that's your area of expertise, but, you know, there's been a lot in the news recently about the way that things like MDMA and ketamine can be used to treat depression and anxiety and post-traumatic stress. And as social attitudes are changing, maybe research is becoming a bit more open into these fields. It's less taboo for scientists to research the effects of psychotropic drugs. How do you feel about those other kind of uses more broadly away from cannabis? And do you think that this is just the start of a bigger sea change that we'll see a sort of society take on a slightly less conservative attitude towards mind and enhancing substances?
I mean, that is absolutely my hope. I think that cannabis is opening a door for not only different substances, but for different jurisdictions to look at drug policy in a different way. You mentioned ketamine, you mentioned MDMA. I know another area of study that is being looked at very closely in North America right now is mushrooms and psilocybin. You know, lots of promise there for PTSD, for depression and anxiety. And I think that as we move forward with cannabis and we have sort of more in-depth study, we're going to be taking a closer look at these other substances, and hopefully we see them, like, I imagine it will sort of roll out the way cannabis did, where there's, you know, a medical allowance, and then of course we'll get into the study a little bit more. But yes, I believe that we'll be seeing some very interesting research in those realms as well.
Amanda Siebert there, talking to Augustine Macellari earlier, and Amanda's little book of cannabis is out now. You're with the Monocle Weekly. Edition 490, count them all. Another one bites the dust. Light and shade, fascinating insights. And we trailed it extensively at the beginning through Identical Strangers. That sort of burned into my brain, that film. I keep, in quiet moments, just thinking about it. It's quite extraordinary as a piece of work.
What would you do if you met a hitherto unknown identical twin on the tube?
I'd probably start by consoling him. I don't know. It's just one of those extraordinary things. And then, of course, I'm not wishing to... I mean, you've slightly given the game away already, but we talked enough about it earlier, I suppose. For it to happen again.
Again.
It's just... Anyway, watch the film. It's quite extraordinary. It comes highly recommended.
Indeed. And pick up Amanda Siebert's book as well, while you're about it.
That is your 490th edition of the Monocle Weekly Org. Why don't you take it away and thank our friends behind the glass?
Indeed I can. Big thanks to Tom Hall, our producer, and Gabriele Delisanti, our researcher. Cassie Galpin and George McDonough have done a sterling job, as always, in their studio managerial role, and we will be back next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Augustine Macellari.
And from me, Tom Edwards. Goodbye.
Goodbye.